Hello, I'm Floyd Maxwell, justthinker.com, doing a Floydcast, number 23, for July 21st, 2014. Got the golf on, got it on mute, ready to go. Alright, I thought I'd lead off with a golf update, seeing as the British Open is on right now. They call it just the Open. Golf originated in Britain. I thought it was Scotland. And so for them, they don't have to say the US Open or the British Open, they say the Open to refer to their tournament, so it's the Open. And in fairness, it is open to the world, so it's the Open. Rory McIlroy, an Irish young fellow, is leading. He's been leading since the tournament started. I wanted to talk about a guy, Jean Van de Velde, a Frenchman who, at one point in, I think, 1999, 15 years ago, Mr. Van de Velde was leading the tournament. I think he could afford a double bogey on the final hole, like two shots worse than average, and still win. And he got a triple bogey. He had a famous adventure on the 18th hole. People could probably talk about some part of it or all of it without even, you know, having seen the clip for years. Basically, he hit it into the rough stuff, and then he hit it from there into... He could have sort of chipped out and taken his losses, but he tried to go to the green from the impossible stuff, and he hit it in the water. There's like a creek. He hit it in the creek. And then there he is taking off his shoes and socks with the whole world watching, the final player, the final hole of this huge tournament. And everyone else is sort of screaming at the television or screaming into their microphone, what is he doing? And finally, he thought he was going to try and hit it from the water. And finally, he decided he picked up the ball, so he took another penalty there, and he made triple bogey, and he lost the Open, the British Open. Well, it occurred to me that I was like, hey, I haven't analyzed this guy's name, like not, you know, fully. I might have analyzed it at the time, you know, 15 years ago, but nothing too much jumped out at me. Well, let's bring some better analysis, some 21st century Floyd analysis to this guy's name. So his name, Jean, 663, and then Van de Velde is 764. Nothing's jumping out there. And then his total is 437, Seven Destiny. Well, one thing you can say about the name Seven Destiny, they say about the Seven Destiny, the person almost makes it. They're almost a success with the Seven Destiny. Well, truly, Van de Velde almost made it. He was almost a hero. But there's something else. There's something called the cycles. I haven't talked too much about them, but they're based on your birthday. So you have numbers from your name, which basically should be, think of it as clear. You want your house to have windows. And a balanced name is a house with windows. An unbalanced name is a house without windows, and you can't see where you're going. Can't see the world going by. And you veer off. So that's the name. Well, the birthday is what you're meant to do. What type of house are you? What type of garden do you plant? What are the qualities that you naturally are drawn to, that you like, that you know, the activities that you like doing, the type of thinking that you have? Some people are good with people. Some people are good being by themselves. Some people are versatile and can do any manner of things. Some people are kind and generous and they want to be teachers. Well, the ideal situation is when you have a name that's not in the way, so we call it a balanced name, and that you know what your birthday qualities are, and then you pursue those qualities. If you're, you know, really good with people and sort of a versatile nature that likes a challenge, well, you're probably going to be a good salesman. It's pretty safe to say that. You can try other things. You can try a sit-down job, but that same versatile, loves a challenge quality, the five quality, is not good when it's 9 to 5, same commute every day, same people in the office every day, same activity every day. That'll drive the five nuts. It just doesn't do well in that environment. So what's Mr. Van de Velde's birthday? May 29, 1966. So to work out his cycle that he was in, for a given year you add his month plus day, and instead of adding his year of birth, you now add the year that he's in. So in other words, May, which is 5, 29, which is 2, which is to say 29 is 9 plus 9 plus 9 plus 2. So let's go 5 plus 2 plus the year, which is 1999, which reduces to a 1. And then you add 1, because when you're 1 year old, you're in your second year of life. So 5 plus 2 plus 1 plus 1. When you work it all out, it adds up to 9. So Mr. Van de Velde was in a 9 cycle year that year at the British Open. Okay, what about in July? Well, July of a 9 year is a 9 month. Okay, what about that famous day? Well, it was the 18th. 1 plus 8 is 9. So he's in a 9-day, a 9-month of a 9-year. Well, what's the 9? As we've talked about, it's the number of losses. There's a saying, they say, something or someone can come into or go out of your life in a 9 cycle. Well, a lot of things came and went for Mr. Vandeveld in that 9 cycle. I was really kind of floored by that. The 9 of the 9 of the 9. I remember once when I was in July of my 9-year, my 9-month, and then I was in a 9-day, and I remember feeling sort of the electricity of that 9-day, of the 9-month, of 9-year, and you just, it's a power. That's what they say about the 9, it's a power, and it adds power to whatever it's with. And it's not meant to be selfish, it's not meant to take, it's not a taking number, that 9. And that's why, you know, you don't win on a 9-day, you're not supposed to. It's not a day for winning. It's a day for planning, getting ready, giving, helping others. And then when that one comes around, now you plant your seeds again. It's the winter time. And how many celebrations are geared around winter, whether it's Thanksgiving or Christmas or New Year's? You know, these are ancient celebrations. In other words, man is meant to do these things at this time of year. In the winter, you give back. If you have more grain than your neighbor, you give some to your neighbor. So how interesting that Mr. Vandeveld, with his almost going to be successful destiny, fails tragically, spectacularly on this 9-day of his 9-month of his 9-year. That's really and truly interesting. A perfect example of the cycles. Well, so then I thought, well, while I'm at it, why don't I analyze all the major players who are still in this year's tournament? And what I did was I started from the person most likely to win, which is Rory McIlroy. What's his cycle? Well, he's in an 8-year, 8-7-month, 1-9-day. He has a 6-shot lead. As soon as I worked at his cycle, I was like, okay, game, set, and match, game over. You know, 8-year, 8-7, that's the fruition, the peak of the harvest. And he's led, you know, each of the 3 days, so I'm not breaking any new ground here to say he's probably going to win. Everyone's picking him to win. But cycles say, yes, he probably will win too. Now, this course is not automatic. This course, literally yesterday, there was like a 5-shot swing in a matter of 1 or 2 holes. So, Rory's leading by 6. There could be a 5-shot swing in 1 or 2 holes, and he could suddenly not be leading. But still, so far so good on, according to the numbers, for Rory. Let's put it that way. Now, his closest competitor, the guy who's 6 shots back, is Ricky Fowler. He's born December 13, so we can work out his cycle. He's in his 6th year. And he's in what's called the latter half of a 6-3 month. And he's been in the latter half for a couple of days now. So, in the latter half of a 3 cycle, they say there could be a disappointment. Sort of guard yourself against a disappointment. So, the numbers say it's not going to work out for him. He's in a pretty good day, a Mission Impossible day today, 8-5, but it's also a 5-day. So, I'm saying no based on his cycle numbers. The next guy after him, 1 shot behind him, is Sergio Garcia. Born January 9th. He's in a 9-year, 9-month. So we'll skip Sergio. He's a great player, and some people picked him at the start of the tournament, but no. And now Sergio's tied with Dustin Johnson for 3rd place. Dustin's born June 22nd. 9-year. He's in a 9-year, 9-month. Isn't that amazing? So you have the guy who's leading by 6 shots. He's in the perfect 8th cycle. And then you have his competitors that so far, 3 for 3, they're in poor cycles. Not the worst. There's one guy lower down here who's worse. We'll get to him. All right, 1 back of those 2 in 4th place by himself. I shouldn't say by himself. There's a bunch of players I'm sort of skipping because they're just sort of unknowns to us North Americans. Victor Dubuisson, another Frenchman. He's born April 22nd. He's in a 7-year, 7-5 month. Now, he's in a pretty good cycle. So I'm going to say that this unknown Victor Dubuisson is going to do pretty good today. Now, the next well-known player in the list of people that is somewhat near the leader is Adam Scott. Well, Adam Scott currently is ranked the number 1 player in the world. He's an Australian. He's a great golfer. He has a fantastic swing. He hasn't done so great this year at the Open. Well, what cycle is he in? He's born July 16. When you work it out, 4-year, 4-8 month. People were predicting Adam Scott at the start of the tournament. For some reason, I was just like, no. I just didn't feel strong on Adam Scott this year at all. Didn't predict him for any of the tournaments. I think the last time he won, I think it was last year. Or some months back, anyway. And then Justin Rose was another candidate. I think he won two of the last three tournaments he played in, including a major. He's doing phenomenal, no doubt. Oh, Justin Rose, July 30th is when he's born. He's in a 9-year, 9-month. Another guy that has no chance, right? Then there's Jordan Spieth, the guy I picked a couple of major tournaments ago to win, and then I picked him to be sort of the backup a major tournament ago. He's not doing so great. Well, what's his cycle? He's born July 27. He's in the 6-year, latter half of a 6-3 month. Isn't it amazing that through all those names I just went through, they're all of them in a poor cycle except for one person, whereas the leader, Rory McIlroy, is in a great cycle, an 8-cycle. So every one of them is reflecting the cycles and helping to predict who's going to win. Now, again, it's not news. You know, Rory is ahead. He's a great player, and it's pretty easy to pick someone when they have a 6-shot lead. But still, it's reflecting the cycles. Okay, I'm going to give a quick update from Toxic document and video and audio file. The story headline this last week was, energy drink plus alcohol mix boosts desire to drink? Quoting, mixing caffeinated energy drinks with alcohol boosts the desire to keep on drinking. It says research was based on a small group of adults in their study, and they said the combination could fuel a higher risk for dangerous binge drinking. They don't know exactly why. Give some of the methodology, 75 volunteers, randomly given different groups. One group got energy drinks combined with fruit juice and vodka, or they just got soda water with fruit juice and vodka. Questionnaires afterwards. In the final paragraph that I've quoted here, the real risk of this combination is that people feel they aren't drunk when they are. That's because caffeine wards off the sedation, the downer, that normally comes when you drink. Well, this is exactly what I say in my document. Wave a red flag pretty firmly when it comes to mixing caffeine and alcohol. And it was probably one of the biggest surprises from my toxic document was how bad caffeine can be when you have too much of it, how bad energy shots are because they make it so easy to take so much caffeine, and then how bad it is to mix it with alcohol. More firmly realized things I took away from my own research. Okay, I'm sort of trying to keep things a little bit more variety today by alternating between sports-related stories and some other stories. So back to the sports, back to the soccer. The World Cup finished up last week, so this is the last World Cup probably related thing I'll be floodcasting about for a while, so you can breathe a sigh of relief. All the soccer widows, as they say. Interesting, soccer widow could be considered sexist, right? Because there could be guys who their spouse likes to watch soccer and they don't, and is that a widower? Widowee? I don't know. I'm out of my field. Widow in any case. I had predicted Argentina would lose to Germany based on officiating. That was like my final prediction. I thought they had a chance if officiating was good, but otherwise, no. One of the things I learned just after I'd done the Floydcast last week was that Germany had 6 players from a single German club team. You know, the teams they play with during the regular season. What they call club teams, or frequently they have the name of a city, so you could call them a city team. And 6 of their players were from one team. Well, that in itself is a huge advantage. One thing I really noticed with Messi, it sort of saddened me a little bit, was when he was playing for the Argentine team, clearly he didn't normally play with these people, number one. And number two, clearly the people he was playing with weren't very good. You know, if you take Messi away from the Argentine team, how would they finish up? They would have been knocked out. I'm pretty sure. He was just playing on an underpowered team, for sure. So in this final game, Argentina versus Germany, Messi had a lot of chances. One of them was really spectacular. He did his Messi thing, and he got in the clear, and he did his delicate little shot, and it missed the side of the net by 2 feet. You know, arguably that was the game. Because the game ended up being tied, it went to extra time. Wait a second, it went to extra time and the Germans scored in extra time? I think that's what happened. They scored near the end of either regular time or the extra time. I've actually forgotten. Interesting that the guy I had said earlier in an earlier podcast I really liked was Schurrle. S-C-H-U-R-R-L-E. Hang on, Pete. Just before I leave the soccer world, this 538.com, with each of those numbers spelled out in letters. This guy, I think it was Ben Morris, he did a couple articles on Messi And this 530E is kind of interesting. They do real sort of research level analysis of stuff. And I've become a real fan of this website. They did an analysis in the story, the link in the story, it says, was the U.S. robbed against Portugal? It depends on what time means. Well, it's a whole piece on stoppage time and how they track time in a soccer game. You may recall that I've talked about with soccer that the time is all sort of out of whack, and in particular, I was saying that they should stop the clock. The commentary for a soccer game is kind of boring. They often don't say anything, and I think part of the reason is, how can you stay fresh for a whole soccer game? The players, when they would need a break, when they're tired, they fake an injury. The clock keeps running, but it's sort of meaningless because then they add it all back in stoppage time, right? Well, it turns out they don't. I'd encourage reading this article. I'm going to have the link available sometime in the year 2200. The bottom line, games typically have 20 or 30 minutes of non-playing time, and yet they only have maybe 5 or 6 minutes of stoppage time. They give a bunch of examples specific to the America versus Ghana game, U.S. versus Ghana. Here's just one of the quotes from the article. In the first half of one of the U.S. matches, the ball was out of play for 18 minutes and 47 seconds in the first half, so roughly 19 minutes. But the referee only added 2 minutes of stoppage time. And then, as part of this article, they quote from football writer Gabriel Marcotti, has argued that officials should stop the clock when a ball is out of play and make each half 30 minutes long. Because it turns out, 15 minutes in the current system, 15 minutes out of the 45 is wasted. So if you just had a 30-minute half, and you stop the clock, problem solved. Isn't that interesting? Another little sentence, an obvious sentence from the article. The inconsistent relationship between dead time and stoppage time could incentivize time wasting. My little comment in my notes, no kidding. It's really one of many shameful practices in soccer. I've pretty much finished the first draft of my soccer document, which I'm going to turn into an audio and a video that no one will watch or listen to, and get that off my to-do list. It's been on there for a few decades. In this case, I'm really only talking about how to fix the design of soccer, and I still have another vanity project talking about the principles of good soccer. Some teams get it, some teams don't. Like England is the classic example of a team that doesn't get the principles of soccer, which the irony of that never ceases to amaze me. You know, the home of soccer, but they don't know how to play it. That's just crazy. But they don't. They have the wrong design of how they play soccer. So one day I might add that or do that as well. But for now, I'm just going to focus on the game itself and what do they need to do to bring soccer into the 21st century and make it truly a beautiful game. Because it isn't right now. It isn't. It's kind of a ridiculous game that everyone freely criticizes. You don't see people doing that with football. They might have an issue with a given thing in football. Like, for example, they started to protect the players from concussions recently, stiffening up some of the penalties. And, you know, you get some talk about that, some chatter. But, you know, honestly, it's all working out. You can be legit in football and be a great team. Seattle last year clobbering. I keep thinking Denver Broncos. I guess it is Denver Broncos. It just seems weird to say that. And thinking of Peyton Manning, I guess I always think of him as a Colt. That's where he used to play, the Colts. Anyway, Seattle won, and they did legitimate tackles, and they swarmed all over Denver, and it wasn't an issue. The rules weren't an issue, the changes weren't an issue, and the players were safer. Soccer can do this too. They can change the game, make their game better. Honestly, when I watch soccer and I look at all the different flaws, it kind of reeks of corruption. And it reminds me of the Olympics. The Olympics strongly reek of corruption. Anyway, so stoppage time scam. A whole article, detailed, thorough, shocking article about the ridiculous stoppage time fiction that's part of soccer. In another part of the article, they were talking about how in the European football, they're saying how the home teams are deliberately taking advantage of this, and they give more time when the home team is losing to give more time to score, right? To catch up, right? They got nothing to lose, right? Because if they're already losing, you're already in the worst-case situation. If you make the game run longer, then your team has more chance to score and tie it up and change the outcome, right? It's just creepy. It's unacceptable. Soccer is a game from 200 years ago that hasn't been revised. Or from 100 years ago at least. It's 100 years out of date. Alright, that's the fun word. There was a story this last week. I guess it's been brewing for a while. I don't know, maybe a year. The story is about a company with an interesting name, Pilot Flying J. I guess this is a truck stop chain. And in the truck stop world, this is a big company. $28 billion of revenue a year. This is a gigantic company based in Knoxville, Tennessee. Chief executive, Jimmy Haslam. And Jimmy Haslam is also the owner of the Cleveland Browns football team. Now, in the football world, the Cleveland Browns are, well, they're like Charlie Brown. You know, Charlie Brown never kicks the football. Well, the Cleveland Browns never win a game sort of thing. I mean, they might win a few, but they never do much year after year. So in the football world, this is a non-story because it doesn't involve a famous team, like a famous great team. But anyway, I was drawn to some article about it, some detail about it, and then I started analyzing everybody's name in this story. So I'm going to just sort of go through now and give you the same information, but I'm going to analyze the numbers along the way. So Pilot Flying J, as a company, is a 652. Remember that too. They're based in Knoxville. Knoxville is 246. In the state of Tennessee, Tennessee, 257. The chief executive is Jimmy Haslam, 279, for the last name. And he has a 257 total. And he's the owner of the Cleveland Browns, well, Cleveland, 246. And Jimmy Haslam is the brother of the Tennessee governor, Bill Haslam. Well, Bill, 988, Haslam, 279, 268 total. Eight destiny, successful destiny. There he is, the governor. But there's that two quality in. So further information in the story, 10 people have pled guilty, including three top sales executives. The company has sort of done a plea bargain, and they've agreed to pay back $85 million that they skimmed. The scam was that when you gassed up there, they said, the more you gas up, the more you save. I don't know if it was based on your miles, I forget what it was, but you should have got some rebates. And what they did was, for the smaller companies, where it was unlikely that any individual would keep track of what their rebate should be, they deliberately gave them roughly 75% of what they were entitled to, and they pocketed the 25%. That's it in a nutshell. But the thing was that the sales executives and that, they taught the new salespeople, and everyone taught everyone to sort of judge your mark, pick your mark. Here's a quote. In one recording, they have an audio recording, so they're kind of nailed on all this stuff. The director of national sales, Brian Mosher, Brian 178, Mosher 246, was caught on tape teaching the fraud to other salespeople. The fate of the top executives remains up in the air, the top executives being that Jimmy Haslam, we've already talked about, President Mark Hazelwood, well, President 112, so his title is two-ish, and then Vice President of Sales, John 652, Freeman 268. Senior Sales Director Jay Stinnett claimed in his plea bargain agreement that top management knew of the scheme. All three of the titles of those three senior executives, every title is two-ish. Another recording indicated the fraud, quote, seems to be openly discussed by employees as high as the vice president of sales. Virtually everybody involved, including the company, it's two-ish. Well, you may recall me talking about a player on the Netherlands team who had a 292 last name, and I said he was sort of truth-challenged. Well, the two quality is truth-challenged. They just don't face it. They do everything but face it. They can be very clever. They can come up with stories. They can distract you and start talking about something else. They don't face it to themselves, and they don't want to face it to others. Whereas they say the one quality is the opposite. You catch the one quality with a hand in the cookie jar, and you say, what are you doing? And they say, I'm stealing a cookie. What do you think I'm doing? The two quality, you know, cooks up a story, says something nice to compliment you, and the next thing you know, you're giving them a hug. They were so sweet. They still stole a cookie. So this company is a 652, and it's saturated with twos just about everywhere. Or the 8 quality. And the 8 is probably the second most challenged, truth-challenged number. The 8 is challenged because they want to make money. And so they can resort sometimes to sort of underhanded ways of making it. The 2 is challenged because they don't want to work hard. Some qualities, they want to work hard. They will go out of the way to choose a hard life because that's what they want. They actually crave that and can relate to it. They feel it's honest work, etc. And that's, of course, the one quality. But even some of the other numbers, like the 4 likes to work, period. And the four is not looking for easy streets, and the four doesn't want to sit on the beach. The four wants to do something. Once you get a four into a job where they can tinker, where they are happy with what they're expected to do, you can count on them for the next 30 years. That's the four quality. They like to work. Well, the two doesn't. The eight doesn't. The story was saturated with those numbers. And it's about as sort of shocking and corrupt a behavior from apparently top to bottom in a company as you'll run across. Maybe one last word, which is sort of somewhat related, is that this company makes 20 or grosses 28 billion a year, and they've agreed to a fine of 85 million. And their supposed fine is only the money that they were going to pay out anyway. This is the modern world, right, where the bigger you are, the more you can get away with, and the smaller the fines. In this case, there's no fine so far. I think there is some talk that some of these people might sue them and whatnot, but honestly, it'll drag on. They won't get much money. The lawyers will get it all. What did this company have to lose in our present system? There was a time, decades ago, where companies disappeared because of legal matters. That all changed. Companies are now treated like people, and you're not allowed to bankrupt them. You're not allowed to. They will specifically moderate the fines so that you don't destroy the company. So the corruption continues. It's basically guaranteed corruption. That's our present system. The ESPN ESPY Awards were given out this past week. You know, the ESPYs is one of those things that ESPN does, that sports does, that's kind of cool. There was a time when the Oscars meant something to us all, whether they should have or not. They were a chance for us all to, you know, reflect on some great movies and get caught up in the pageantry of it all. And, you know, nowadays, you know, the Oscars are a joke. I think for me, it started with the movie Crash, when Crash won it all. And then I watched the movie, I was like, okay, I no longer trust the Oscars ever after Crash. So shockingly pointless and bad and banal and any other word you want to add to it. The notion of this winning it all, creepy. Whereas the ESPYs, it's real life. Sports are real life, real people, real accomplishment, real sacrifice, and real great people. Not all of them. Some of them are a little egotistical, but hey, they're young, right? Sports is for the young, generally. It's not surprising that some of them haven't got their ego in check yet. So, I wanted to feature the guy who won one of the top awards. Some of the awards are for like the best male athlete, best female athlete of the year kind of thing. But this one's called, I think, the Jimmy V Perseverance Award. The ESPYs is tied to a Jimmy V Foundation. Jimmy Valvano was a famous, I don't even remember his backstory now, but he became this spokesman against, you know, stand up to cancer kind of thing. He delivered a famous speech near the end of his life, and ESPN has tied all of that with the ESPYs. So they have this Jimmy V Perseverance Award. Well, they gave it to Stuart Scott this year. Stuart Scott is an ESPN announcer or host. He's a great guy, a lot of character to this guy. He comes up, you know, many of the great announcers, they come up with terms or sayings that you then associate the term with the person. Like with Stuart Scott, booyah was one of his sayings. And another one is when a player would do something that was very casually done but very well done, his saying is, as cool as the other side of the pillow. I became curious because he said this cancer, he's been fighting it for years and whatnot. The history is he had an emergency appendectomy sometime around 2007, November 2007. And at that time, they discovered a malignancy that required an additional surgery to remove. In 2011, it was revealed that he was fighting cancer again. The disease entered remission in 2012, but he was diagnosed again in 2013. That stinks, right? Some people get this. They get it, they fight it, they get it, they fight it. And in his case, he gets it again. Well, let's look at his name. Stuart. It's not what I consider the usual or English spelling of Stuart. Jimmy Stuart is S-T-E-W-A-R-T. And in this case, Stuart Scott is S-T-U-A-R-T. Well, the S-T-U-A-R-T is 459. His last name, Scott, 685. When you add them together, 1-4-5, 5 destiny. Well, you don't want a 5 destiny. Bad things happen to someone with a 5 destiny. The 5 is very intense, for starters. Stuart Scott has 2 5s in 2 positions. Last name, so he grew up in a 5-ish intense family. And then he's got an intense 5 destiny, you know. Just think about how much does an ESPN person travel? Sports are all over the world. I know Mike Tirico and a whole bunch of others were down in Brazil covering the World Cup soccer. Well, guess where Mike Tirico is today? He's in England covering the Open in golf. Mike Tirico is a fantastic announcer. I just love this guy. He's just perfect. He's note perfect. He's one of these guys that you just marvel at how easy he makes it all happen. But there he is, Brazil 1 minute, England the next, and then he'll be home next week. What does that do to your body? So, Mr. Scott with his fives, whirlwind, you know. When you're young and that five, you know, you're kind of like, hey, this is exciting. I'm doing exciting things. But after a while, your body is saying, hey, enough of that. Let's settle down. But you can't settle down with the five quality. Certainly not with the five destiny. Then let's look at the first name, the steward, 459. The 459 is considered a discordant combination. The four has limited vision and sort of a plodding, one foot after the other kind of quality. And then the nine is an everything vision, the broadest vision. Your hands extended as you welcome everyone to the convention quality. They don't go together, those two qualities. Beats. The nine wants to express all to everyone, and the four is a limited source to draw from. The four is also slows down the elimination, as we've talked about. And then the four desires the heavy, the wrong foods. Well, it's a cancer combination. So he's got cancer for a first name, he's got the fives and the last name and the destiny, which in itself would be bad. It's not really any surprise that he had this all happen to him. He's taken it very graciously, and, you know, hats off to him. He's been a standout, and often five-ish people are like that. The five supports the underdog, and they can be nasty if they're against you, but the five will defend their friends to the death kind of thing, and then on their own challenges, the five will just sort of shrug and go, oh, that's the way it goes. Because the five is a bit naive, right? And they just figure, oh, bad luck. The five doesn't necessarily think deeply about things. That's the strike, one of the big strikes against the five. Much of these scams that are pulled off in this world are pulled off because people are five-ish. Most people are five-ish. You know, you have six prominent positions in your name, assuming you only have one first name, one last name, and you sign that way in your total. So you have six positions minimum. Well, there are nine numbers. So statistically, two out of every three people have at least one five quality. Well, the five quality is one of these qualities that dominates a name. When you've got it, it affects you. In my family, it was an unusually non-five-ish family. And I remember working it out. And out of all of us, seven people, there was a total of two five qualities, one each for two people. Now, two-thirds of a chance per person times seven, that should have been, I guess it should have been three. So maybe statistically, it was about on par with what was expected. It was slightly lower than normal, I guess. But it's interesting, both the people that it affected them both in the same position, the way they think about the future. Those two people are extremely close, as it happens in the family, and both are religious. Well, that's again showing that naivety of the five. Religion is something for the naive person, among other types to get trapped by religion. So, poor Stuart, struggling, fighting cancer, getting this award. You know, he's a treat to listen to, and I'm sorry that it all happened to him, but hey, cancer happens for a reason. It happens because of your name, and it also happens because of your diet. It happens, in his case, because probably, you know, a bit of lifestyle stuff of traveling a lot. And just the discord in the name. Anyway, one of his quotes I just wanted to say, when he was giving a speech, he said, "You beat cancer by how you live, why you live, and the manner in which you live." Well, that all can come down to one word. Why you live. Because the how is related to the why. If you live selflessly for others, you will get your life in order so that your life is not in the way of helping others. Conversely, if you're like the average unenlightened person, you don't have a good why for why you live. So then you don't have a good how. You don't research what do hamburgers do to you. You know, you don't stop eating hamburgers. And so the manner in which you live, well, that's tied to the how, right? So it all comes down to the why. Well, you know, he has a good saying. Often these cancer survivors, they have good sayings because they've heard them from others. But it didn't help them. You got to have more than just a good quotation. That's not going to save you from cancer. Cancer is a, well, let's have a look, what have you been doing kind of a thing. You can't stuff down meat without it having a consequence. You cannot do it. They will lie forever and say, yes, you can. Meat is harmless. Who cares? It's good for you. Blah, blah, blah. Bacon sounds good. No. You will pay for it. You will pay for all the bacon that you eat. So, interesting. There's another well-known person. Who was at this ESPYs? She's from, I want to say NBC. Robin Roberts. She's another famous person fighting cancer. And she, diagnosed breast cancer and myelodysplastic syndrome, MDS, a disease of the bone marrow. So let's look at her name. Well, Robin, 674. Now we've talked about the four is the cancer number. Well, she's got it right in the first name. Roberts, her last name, 257. Well, I think I've at least talked about it at least once in the past, but the 257 is not a strong combination. You want to avoid the 257. I remember running into a guy shortly after I found out about this principle. He was a teacher of a course, and I'm trying to remember the course. I think it was like geography. When I was going back to university, and I took a break for a while, and then I went back, and I wanted to sort of cut down my workload because I sort of had studied, you know, what had happened to me, and I had this super, it was like a double workload when I was taking engineering the first time around, and I realized, hey, I got to get rid of some of these courses and so I can have a more normal workload. You know, you have to take electives. So I took a couple of simple electives so that, and I took one of them at night school so that it wasn't part of my regular schooling so that I got rid of that load. I just remember this guy in the building. And it wasn't a normal building that I went to, so, you know, it could have been that. Anyway, his name was Vernon Fowler. Doesn't sound like a great name, does it? Vernon is 257. Fowler is 257. This guy was a double dose of 257. He looked like he was 106. He was probably in his 30s. He looked horrific. I think he smoked. He looked as frail. He looked like he could snap. If he fell the wrong way, he would snap. He was like in that movie Unbreakable. He was Samuel L. Jackson in that movie. And it was like, well, there you go. There's the 257 double dose in action. No doubt about it. So anyway, sadly, Robin Roberts, her last name, 257, a weak last name, a cancer first name. What do you think's going to happen? All right, I feel myself being pulled towards my of the weeks. It's a little early, but I've got quite a few of them and might go through a little bit more of it than usual. Some of them, you know, sort of feel important to me as well, but I categorize them as of the weeks. Cool and uncool things of the week, or yeah, they're of the weeks, but they can also be kind of important. Small stories. You say them, you say your opinion about them, and you move on. Wash your mouth out with soap afterwards with some of these. Bad driver of the week. Well, someone I know had a car back into them, into their car, this past week. Now here's the scenario. You decide who was at fault here. My friend was in their car. They were parked. The engine was off. They still had their seatbelt on. And they were going to wait. They were waiting for somebody. Another car comes along, pulls up. I think it was like a Lexus or Infiniti or something, some fancy car. And he's going to start backing in behind them. And right away, my friend realized that they weren't going to fit. And they started shouting at them. And the other person ignored it, kept backing up. And then the person was actually started scraping the car and is keeping on going. So then my friend honked at them. Then they stopped and they pulled forward. So they did the old exchange information and all that. And offhandedly, the bad driver said that, oh, well, now they can fix the dent on my car. And then my friend was a little bit upset by all this and hadn't been in an accident in forever, either their whole life, I forget, or in a very, very long time. And this guy sort of said, ah, it's no big deal. I've been in 10 accidents. And then he said, if you're really so upset about it, you can scratch my car if you want. This is how casually this person responded to the whole situation. Now get ready for this person's profession. They're a doctor. That's a real jaw dropper. Doubling up on my of the week, so I'm going to give you another driving one. You know, I just glanced over to the, I got the TV on the British Open. And Rory McIlroy, the guy who's leading the Open, he just pulled up to the Open, getting ready to play. And they showed him getting out of a Mercedes. And this is one of the many vehicles that is loaned to the British Open. In this case, by Mercedes, sometimes it's by Lexus, these high-end car companies. Sports has come a long way when you show up for work in a free Mercedes. And these guys just all accept it. It's just all part of the course. My bad driving story. This happened last week. I do a regular once a week trip where I go 12 miles away and go and do something routine. And as part of doing that, I have to drive downtown and then through the downtown, mostly on sort of good roads, fast roads, bypass roads. You go through a period of time, a brief period of time, where you sort of have to merge, you know, with a lot of other traffic, basically. And then you get back on the highway and, you know, most of it's highway driving. Well, in the place where I'm thinking of, you have traffic that's, there's traffic light every block kind of thing. And then you're getting towards the on-ramp to the highway that I end up wanting to get on later on. And depending on the time of day, the traffic can back up a little bit. And there's one on-ramp lane, but the traffic, it's like typically two lanes merged together. And it's sort of one of these things where if you don't know how to get there, and if you're following your GPS, it'll tell you to get in the left lane. And the left lane is always more busy than the other lanes. But some of us, you know, we don't mind producing a little bit of friction with other drivers by staying in the right lane, which often has, you know, five times less traffic, and then just merging at the last minute. And this is one of these things where it may not be your cup of tea to do that, but it's my cup of tea. So I'm in the right-hand lane, the controversial lane, we'll call it, and there's five cars in front of me in that lane, or four cars. And we're all merging, as it turns out. And so we're in our merge point, and in front of me I see a city bus in the right-hand lane merging. So if a city bus is in the right-hand lane merging, it's pretty much an accepted fact that it happens. I think you can't get more cautious and conservative than a city bus driver, right? And this guy was going to the garage. This isn't a regular route. I don't regularly see a bus driver. I don't know if I've ever seen a bus driver in the right-hand lane. So that surprised me. Anyway, so he merges, and the guys in front of me merge, and now it's my turn. Well, as I go to merge, I notice that the vehicle that's in the left lane behind me is not really backing down. And in fact, they're crowding me. So I speed up a little bit and sort of cut my distance even less to the car in front of me. In other words, it's getting a little tight for me to get in. The vehicle behind me surges and takes up the slack again. So now it's going to be one of these things where I'm just going to ride it out. In other words, I'm just going to stay where I am, and I got a truck. If I have to go up in a curb, I'll go up in a curb, but I'm not backing down. Everyone else is being civilized. If the guy behind me doesn't want to be civilized, that's his problem. This happens every light, every day. This is a constant. So then this guy honked at me, and he had a big vehicle, which was kind of intimidating. What was his big vehicle? It was a city bus. I got road raged by a city bus, also going to the garage. But the truly bizarre thing was that right in front of both of us, his buddy in another city bus had done the merge. Nobody honked at him. They let him in. But now this guy was freaking out that I was doing the same thing. That, I thought, was a spectacularly inconsistent thing for a bus driver to do. And it really, truly surprised me. Well, what happens is when you do this merge, you go onto this single lane, right? And it's a single lane where you've got concrete on one side, concrete on the other side. There's no passing for about a block or two. So this bus driver is laying on the horn with me, which is just so extraordinarily unusual. Let's just say I elected to consider the environment for the next couple of blocks. And, you know, one of the things, if you're trying to drive very conscientiously and not pollute very much, is you feather the gas pedal. You go very light on the gas. You don't just stomp on the gas. Well, I feathered that gas pedal for the next couple of blocks. These guys, they road rage you at a point where you're only going to lose. What are you accomplishing? Why was he doing that? He's a bus driver. This happens. He's probably seen this 1,000 times before. His friend did it in front of him. This guy truly snapped. And it's the kind of guy that should be reported. And I didn't think about it strongly at the time. I don't know why. I think I was sort of amused and kind of amazed by it. You know, bad driver of the week popped to mind, and I was like, and that sort of helped me so much in handling it that I didn't kick in my normal mode where sometimes I report bad drivers. You know, this guy should have been reported. He shouldn't be a bus driver. Bus drivers should not road rage. Bus drivers should not be so illogical. He used his vehicle in a threatening way. Absolutely. Let's put it this way. If I was an undercover cop and he did what he did, he'd be on the side of the road. I'd be giving him a citation, and he might lose his job. Simple as that. You don't fool around with a bus. That's bringing a gun to a knife fight. Is that how the saying goes? Anyway, so that's my second story. Alright, in my rewatch of the week, I'll give you two again. I'll give you a quick one. The first one was The Emperor's Club. It was a 2002 movie with Kevin Kline. He plays a professor at a distinguished college, trying to influence his kids. And it's one of these sort of epic tales where you see him in his younger years and in his older years. It's a good movie. Kevin Kline does a good job. I guess he has a bit of a scholarly background. Worth watching. The movie reminded some people online were comparing it to Dead Poets Society, and others were getting incensed by that. You know, these days everything is an argument. It's not just a, hey, good point. Anyway, there are some similarities. Dead Poets and The Emperor's Club both, you know, they're set at a fancy college, and it's an interesting teacher trying to influence his kids, right? And that's sort of where the similarities end. But the movie that it also reminded me of is a movie called Goodbye, Mr. Chips. There's two versions of Goodbye, Mr. Chips. There's an older one. And then there's the 1969 version with Peter O'Toole. Well, Peter O'Toole was at the top of his game in the 60s. He did Lawrence of Arabia then. Peter O'Toole is, I guess he's passed now. I think he passed last year. But what a truly distinguished actor, truly great actor. One of my favorites, without a doubt. Well, Goodbye, Mr. Chips. I routinely watch that over and over again. Great, great movie. And so that's a shout-out to one and a rewatch of the other. All right, the other movie that I rewatched yesterday, it's called A Brief History of Time. Famous title by Stephen Hawking. You know, Stephen Hawking is the guy who we all feel sorry for. He's in a wheelchair. He's got an unusual voice because it's a computer-generated voice. He can't talk any longer. And we go, ah, poor guy, you know. And so he's a well-known physicist, arguably one of the most well-known. When you dig a little deeper, in my mind, his physics is, you know, he's done some stuff that, let's just say he's taken conventional physics and he's run with it. And, you know, hats off to him for that. There are many physicists that appear on TV that haven't done much running. Well, Stephen Hawking has done some running with physics, but it's with conventional physics. And today, personally, I use that as fuel for my own theory. When you hear something that doesn't ring true with your own theory and with sort of a more common sense approach, it elucidates your own theory. It makes your own theory shine. And you see the flaws in the other person's thinking. You know, when you build a house of cards, no matter how carefully you build those floors, it's on a house of cards. And that's physics today. One of the interesting things in the documentary, A Brief History of Time is a documentary, even though it's, well, I guess his book is a, you could say a documentary book or an educational book. Oh, excuse me, stretching there. Anyway, getting away from the physics, Mr. Hawking was a drinker when he was younger. And it sounded like he was a hefty drinker. And somewhat related to that, he didn't study much because he was brilliant. And again, you know, we sort of give people a pass when certain things are true. When they're a genius, we give them a pass, right? They could be a genius with Tourette's, but we're like, well, he's a genius. What do you expect? When he was studying at college or university in his youth, he worked it out later that in his studying years, his student years, he studied an average of 1 hour per day. The average is probably, I'm going to guess, 3 hours a day. And some people probably study 5 or 6. For many, it's a full-time job, and they have to study very long hours. If you can get away with 1 hour a day, you're pretty bright. I think of myself, I probably did an hour a day. And by the way, Stephen Hawking, he's not proud of it. He says in the documentary that he wasn't proud of how little he studied. I wasn't proud of it either. And I changed the second time around, and I probably upped it to 2 hours a day. I went through, did 3 years, and on the third year, I'd lost interest. I ended up having to come back and retake 2 or 3 courses, and I had more interest when I came back. That was the key. When I went away, is I realized, hey, I'm not coming back until I want to come back. And then I wanted to come back, and I came back, and I got my degree. I'm not alone in that, right? When you go right from 12 years of boring school into university where you think it's going to be boring, and then there's always some challenge, right? Whether it's, in my case, you know, the challenge was engineering. They give you a double workload. I foolishly took, in my third year, I took honors organic chemistry. I don't know why. You had 2 choices, and I took the tougher one of the 2. I don't know why I did that. And it's easy to get too much work. And then, of course, I was only doing like an hour a day, and the rest of the time I'd be hanging around the pinball video game arcade. And I just never really cared for studying. You know, there's always a dilemma, right? I like learning, but I don't like having to study what someone else thinks is important. That's my dilemma. I used to be the type that would hang around the back of the class talking all the time and eating my lunch and copying assignments from other people. I guess basically I was fooling myself when it came to my studentship. But I followed what the teacher was saying. I remember one time one of the courses I was taking was being taught by the head of the department, the head of the chemical engineering department, John Grace. And he was a guy who probably, you know, sort of fancied himself a little bit. And he was, you know, a little more versatile, a little more quick than some of the other profs, a little more aware. Some of them were incredibly unaware of their environment, of other people, of the students in front of them. They were they were researchers. Well, he, being the department head, he was a more human type guy. And he was probably a little miffed one day when I was talking so much. And out of the blue, he asked me a question. And he thought I wasn't following. Well, I immediately gave him the answer. That kind of meant that he wasn't going to ask me again ever. But my point is that the way I approach my schooling, and probably Hawking did exactly the same thing, is you parse what you're being taught. In other words, as it's coming into you first time, what I do is I say, does it make sense? Does it make sense? And for everything that makes sense, I just discard it, or I don't think twice about it, because it makes sense, right? And for things I have to wrestle with, I start wrestling with them right at that moment. Hang on, please. And I get a sort of bit of internal kind of desperation, because suddenly I don't get something and I want to get it right then and there. Because so many things, especially in sort of left-brained fields, everything is built on everything else. Math is built on math. If you don't understand the math you're being given right now, you're not going to understand it, what's being given to you 5 minutes from now. So that's the way I was bored, not paying attention, whatever, writing it down, but talking about something else, joking with my friends. And then, wait a minute, I didn't get that. And suddenly, I'm not the life of the party. I'm like, whoa, wait a minute. And then, oh, okay, I think I get it. Or I might put a star next to my notes and like, I gotta like think about that twice, once later on. Well, if you do that, most of your note-taking, most of the stuff in the class, you get it by the time you leave the class. So there's no homework based on your class time. You know, the only homework is they give you problems to do. And I don't know why, but especially in my engineering, I would copy from my friends all the time on problems. I almost never did them myself. Oh, man. In my final year, I would go ice skating in the morning. I ended up getting one-on-one instruction from a guy who used to be second best in the U.S., fourth best in the world figure skater, who was teaching a power skating class. Figure skating and power skating are actually related, power skating being what hockey players do. But it's very strongly related to figure skating. Figure skating is a power activity, but it just doesn't look like it. You know, it's the old thing of good technique. Figure skating is good technique, and if you use good technique in skating, then you're also powerful and fast. When I started taking this power skating class, it was $10, subsidized by the university. It was like 12 sessions for $10. I think maybe, let's say 10 sessions, $10. It could have been 20, though. I think it was 20. 50 cents a session. And when the class started, there was like 10 or 12 of us. By the end of the class, people were worried about their exams. I was the only one for the last couple of classes. I was literally getting one-on-one instruction, 50 cents a pop. I became good at skating. I mean, I already liked skating. I was already pretty good at it. But that really took me to the next level. It was awesome. So I would go skating in the morning. And then I didn't have an 8:30 class because I'd already taken that class in some previous time. Anyway, I'd come in at 10:30. I'd missed the 9:30 class. I would copy those notes from my friend, copy problems from whoever had done them for whatever course problems were due, and take the notes for the 10:30 class, and eat my lunch either in the 10:30 or 11:30 class, all at the same time in the back of the class while I'm talking with my friends. That was disrespectful, I'll admit. Anyway, the point is I can relate to Mr. Hawking doing this 1 hour a day. And what was really interesting and what I made the note of was he was a drinker. And when he was diagnosed with his ALS, and by the way, there are at least three types of ALS. Some of them are shorten your life like Lou Gehrig, but some of them, and it depends on what it affects. And in this one article, which I got the link for, and 60 years from now I'll have it on my website. In this one article, this was from Discover Magazine, if you're curious, July 2009. They said that it depends what the ALS or Lou Gehrig's affects. And you basically need to swallow and breathe, and your heart needs to tick, and your brain, right? And if it affects something else, you can live a long life. And this is what's happened with Stephen Hawking, is his heart still beats, his brain still works, his lungs still breathe, but he's lost the use of his body. Well, this drinking thing really interested me, and I tried to research it, and I did find a little bit. And one of the things was, when he was diagnosed with his ALS, his doctor specifically said for him to cut down on his drinking. And if you research on drinking, there was even a story. It turned out it was basically a made-up and really a cheap shot story. But it was talking about him going to some establishment and drinking champagne and having girls. And it turned out that particular story wasn't true, like it didn't happen recently, but they did admit that he at least once was at that very establishment, which was, let's say, a ladies and drinking establishment. I thought that was very interesting, you know, alcohol, the toxicity of alcohol. You can't get away with it. You can't get away with drinking and think it's not going to affect you, even if you're a physicist. So that was my second rewatch of the week. I have a great deal of accumulated cool and uncool things of the week, so I want to go through some of those. Some interesting things happened this past week, and I'm just going to sort of talk about them. Well, the city of Washington, D.C., District of Columbia, the one back east, not the state, they decriminalized cannabis this past week. And I guess the actual detail is now if they pull you over and you got a big bag of pot sitting on your lap, they now will confiscate it. They will confiscate it and send you on your way. Probably it's dependent on how much you have, and if you have too much, then you're a trafficker and you get 20 years, but at some random amount level. For many people, they might think that's a cool thing of the week. I don't think it's cool. I don't encourage people to use pot. I think compared to other drugs, pot is arguably one of the best, one of the least harmful, one of the ones that can help you if you have chronic pain, for example. Let's say you're miserable. For some reason, you know, your physical body has let you down. Let's say you're Stephen Hawking. I would have no problem with Stephen Hawking eating hash brownies. But honestly, I think he probably enjoys his physics more than he would enjoy pot. Another event, an unfortunate event, a plane was shot down in the Ukraine, supposedly by Russia. It's a major event. CNN is all over it, showing the, you know, all the things they have to do after a tragedy like that. People combing through the wreckage, etc. There was some video which showed a big boom when the plane hit. It's one of these very graphic stories that will capture the news channels pretty thoroughly for the next few weeks or months. And then there was another story. In England, in Britain, they rushed through some very severe security surveillance measures. And I forget the details. You know, you can look it up. If you live there, you know what they are. If you don't live there, well, it doesn't affect you. Not trying to trivialize it, but Britain, already one of the most surveilled, and they have the most cameras, surveillance of any country per person. Anyway, they just went to the next level down the sliding scale towards a police state, a police world. Well, something else happened this last week. Let me think now. So that's three big things that happened this last week. Something else happened. Oh yeah, Israel invaded Palestine because Hamas apparently did something. Hamas is allegedly this Palestinian terrorist group. I think there's another one as well, but Hamas and another one. And it's interesting, just when I was sort of in between recordings here this morning, CNN was quoting the Israeli PM saying, Hamas are the, quote, worst terrorists. I didn't know there was a terrorist rating system. You know, really, Hamas has been extremely good for Israel. If Hamas didn't exist, Israel would have benefited from creating it. Because, you know, when you got a bad guy, right, then you need a good guy. And the good guy needs guns, right? Well, the U.S. sends lots of guns to Israel, lots of nuclear bombs and jet fighters and all that kind of stuff to Israel. By the tens of billions of dollars a year. It's a big business. Yeah. So Hamas has actually been very good to Israel. So I would say rather than Hamas being the worst terrorist, you could say they're the best terrorists for Israel. because Israel gets a lot from that. Anyway, just a little coincidence, not being talked about that much, because it seems like there's a lot of other big stories this past week. Somewhat related, and that's a war story. This is someone digging through the history files from 100 years ago. Exactly 100 years ago. Quote, "The assassination of Archduke Francis Ferdinand, the heir to the thrones of Austria and Hungary, and of the Duchess of Hohenberg, his consort, was the result of a widespread plot, the extent of which the actual actors were perhaps unaware of, now appears to be beyond doubt." So basically there was conspiracy surrounding his assassination, and maybe events were a little more planned than we were led on 100 years ago. All right, in keeping with the two of everything in the of the weeks, two quotes. One is a quick one from Argentina's coach, Lionel Messi's coach. The Argentine coach said, "Water in the desert," and he was referring to Lionel Messi. Lionel Messi was the water in the desert that his team needed. Well, that was about it. If he'd had, you know, a couple of other good guys or one other good striker, the guy Higuain, who I talked about in previous podcasts, who scored a goal and almost scored another one. Well, he almost scored one or two on this last final as well. And again, just not quite up to the job. Almost any other player probably in the same situation would have scored, and Higuain gave it his best but didn't quite score. The second quote I'm going to go with, they were talking on Slashdot about something, and something to do with advertising came up. And my thought is, how would companies lie to us about products if they didn't have advertisements? How would they do it? Advertisements aren't, "Hey, we have a product, don't you know," annoying. They're not just annoying. They're a vehicle for lying. So much of life is lying. Many, most of the fiction movies are lies in disguise. They have a message. And if the message ain't right, if it ain't reasonable, if it ain't fair, if it ain't honest, it's a lie. The news is full of lies. It's really, they should change the name of news to lies. "Good evening, here are the lies." That's really more accurate. And it would prepare you so that you would filter more. So we swim in lies. In 2014, in this wonderful Western world, we swim in lies. You know, you can think of that as being cynical, to say the least. It's absolutely cynical. But is it true? Is what I'm saying about lies true? It behooves you to know one thing. To take everything with the largest amount of salt that you can choke down. Ads are lies. You know, they were talking online about ads and how to avoid ads and do they need ads. I think it was to do with, you know, like YouTube and some others, you know, and having ads as part of their product sort of thing. And there's always this sort of this debate, well, if it wasn't for ads, you wouldn't get the product for free. I think what they were saying was, if it wasn't for ads, the internet wouldn't exist kind of thing. That's how bad, how extreme the opinions got. As others said, you know, the internet existed before ads, so ads are by no means essential. And ads are from opportunists. But most importantly, ads are not companies selling stuff. Companies sell stuff, good stuff, by word of mouth. They sell stuff by, you drive by their dealership. You could say that their sign, Bob's Cars, could say their sign is an ad, but it's not an ad. It's just a sign saying, this is what we do. And it's up to you to decide, do you want to go on with their lot or not? And if you have a bad experience with that dealer, well, you tell everybody, I had a bad experience with that dealer, and you don't. You discourage everyone from going there, and they build up a bad reputation. Speaking of dealers, there was a dealer in Washington State. I was looking for pricing on a car out of state on purpose so that if they try and hound me, it'll be this company from out of state, and I will know forever after. Well, sure enough, these guys, even though I've contacted them numerous times, they have become the ultimate spammers of me. It's unbelievable. Yes, I have filters. Anything with the word Tonkin in it goes right into the trash. But you know, my trash can gets pretty heavy in my email program, thanks to you guys. Ads are lies. Start with that. News is lies and ads are lies. Anyone shouting a message at you is lying. Start with that assumption. It will make it a little bit harder for their lies to have an effect. A little bit, not a lot. Because still, they have all the money. So they have all the ads. They control all the ads. And then you see the little local ad that appears, you know, when you're watching a TV show and you have all these national ads with $1 million budgets. And then you see the little local $5,000 budget ad.
it's kind of hard to take it seriously, right? Because of all those expensive ads. But really, that local ad is probably a lot more honest in many cases than the national one. Sort of ironic. So they control the message with money. That's what copyright issues are about. They're not about people copying programs. They could care less. They've already made their money off their movies. They could care less. It's about controlling the message. They don't want you modifying their movies, and they want to be able to stuff their ads, their trailers, their spoilers into the movies. They want to control everything from top to bottom, everywhere. And they do pretty effectively do that. How would they lie to us if they couldn't run ads? Well, the golf is just finishing up. They're on the last hole. And Rory McIlroy has the 3-shot lead. He started with 6, and, you know, things fluctuated and whatnot. But I don't think he lost the lead today. It got close, but he didn't lose it. And the others have played great. The guy I said was in a Mission Impossible day, Ricky Fowler, he is -4 for a day. That's phenomenal. One of the best rounds of the day. But it's not enough. Sergio Garcia had a good day. He's a good guy. You know, Sergio was in that 9-year, 9-month type thing. And I was saying he didn't have a chance. That's sort of not fair to the 9. On the higher side, if someone has been living that 9 sort of perfectly, they can have a great day. But it's less likely that someone in a 9 cycle is going to win over someone in an 8 cycle, all other things being equal. So just wrapping up, Sergio just putted his last putt. They're giving him a standing ovation, but he's still a couple shots back. You can just sort of see it in his eyes that not quite. Close again. Anyway, it's been great golf. All right, I normally finish up with my quote of the week, so I guess I'll finish up now. This has been Floyd and Maxwell, justthinkit.com, doing a Floydcast number 23 for July 21st, 2014. Good luck with your life. Take care.